Lecture 34, Gandhi, an Autobiography.
In our last lecture, we discuss Cicero and his work on moral duties. De Officiis is the Latin title. It is normally translated as on moral duties. It can be called on obligations. It can be called on responsibility. For its theme is that the basis of all morality and good action is doing what is true and just and right. That is your responsibility. And that there will be no ultimate dichotomy between doing what is best for you and doing what is right, because you can never profit from doing wrong. It is a great book, and it is a book that certainly changed history. It is one of the most influential ethical works ever written. And Cicero would go on to be, for the Middle Ages, for the Renaissance, right on down through the Enlightenment, the most influential single intellectual figure from Greece and Rome. His Latin was the model that was used in schools in the Middle Ages and Renaissance, when all educated people wrote in Latin. And the work on moral duties was held up as the epitome of what a pagan could achieve in terms of ethical thought. And indeed, he was regarded as a pagan Christian, so much like the teaching of Christianity was his own teaching on ethics. How powerful was the view of Cicero can be seen from the fact that, as I believe, Machiavelli wrote his The Prince, which we have discussed, in a determined effort to refute Cicero, to show that it is absolute nonsense to say that a good act is always expedient. Very frequently, it is expedient to do evil. And you ought to get this foolish notion of always doing right out of your mind. You must do what is best for you, and that will frequently be to lie, to cheat, to kill, to be cruel, to be stingy. And it's a question of how Cicero, if he would step back, would view all that has been written about him in subsequent generations. Because to his own generation, Cicero was a failure. After all, he stood up for the free republic and got himself killed, did he not? I mean, to get killed by a policeman is a sign of failure. And then the free republic was never restored. Augustus would go on and establish a military dictatorship far more efficient than Caesar had ever achieved. And that new order of Augustus would bring peace and prosperity to a world that had been very badly governed by the Free Republic of Rome. Therefore, the most influential Roman historian of the 19th century, the great Theodore Mommsen, viewed Cicero as a total failure and a real detriment to his country, who delayed the progress of the new order of Caesar and Augustus, and despised the writings of Cicero. He called them journalism of the worst sort, because they weren't serious philosophical treatises. They were an attempt to make philosophy comprehensible by ordinary people. Cicero would come back and say to you, I was a success because I was true to myself. And that is our theme in all of these three great figures we're going to look at now. Be true to yourself, do what you know to be right, and never give up. And to see that in a very different world, let us turn our minds back to the winter in South Africa of 1893. And on a train going towards Pretoria is a young 24-year-old, recently qualified English barrister, lawyer, Mohandas Gandhi. And he is riding in the first-class compartment. He is on company business. He represents an Indian company there in South Africa, which is responsible for a number of Indian migrant workers. And he has his first-class ticket, riding along, and suddenly the conductor appears in the railroad carriage and says, "What are you doing here?" with a racial slur. "What are you doing here?" And Gandhi says, "I am going to Pretoria." "Not in this compartment, you're not." "Well, why not? I have my ticket." "I don't care about your ticket. This is a first-class compartment, and only white people may sit in this first-class compartment. So you get out of here right now. But I have a first-class ticket. You're going to sit in the third-class compartment. But I paid for a first-class ticket. I do not care. Sir, I am an attorney. You cannot be an attorney. There are no colored attorneys in South Africa. Well, sir, since you call me colored, and since I have a letter here from the Queen stating that I am a fully qualified barrister, there must be at least one colored attorney in South Africa. Don't you get smart with me. You're going out. All right. You either go out of this train or at the next stop, we're throwing you out. I will not leave this train. All right. Next stop, policeman comes and says, you're going out of this train. And he is summarily thrown off the train and his luggage is thrown after him. And off puffs the train. There he is sitting on the railroad side, cold night, high in the mountains of South Africa. And so outraged that he won't even go and get his luggage, which is now in the possession of the police, so he can get his overcoat out. Next train comes, gets in the compartment he's assigned to, and then goes on. And at the little town where he has to stop, there is a stagecoach that will take him the final stage of the journey. He starts to get into the stagecoach, once again has a first-class ticket for the stagecoach. The driver looks down and says, you can't sit inside with the white people. But, sir, I have a ticket. I don't care. You're going to sit, I don't know where. You're going to sit on the floorboard here. I am not going to sit on the floorboard of the stagecoach if I have a first-class ticket. Oh, yes, you are. All right, I'll tell you what I'll let you do. You can sit up here beside the driver. The other driver, and I'll sit inside to relieve him later. Time comes to relieve the driver. The chief gets on top and says, you're going to get down on the running board now. And Dr. Gandhi says, no. So the chief begins to beat him in the ears and pound on him. And Gandhi's a very frail little man, never weighed much more than 100 pounds. This is an enormous stagecoach driver, and he's pounding him and pounding him. And then he starts to drag him and throw him on the ground. And Gandhi just holds on to the edge of the stage until finally the passengers themselves are outraged and said, let him sit inside with us. No, I'm not going to let him sit inside, but I will let him sit on the floorboard rather than throwing him away. And so Gandhi is introduced to the customs of the British Empire and its legal system. The British Raj at the height of its imperial power. That empire on which the sun never sets. That empire that stretches from the Cape to Cairo, stretches from the antipodes of Australia to the pine forest and tundra of Canada, and which is based upon the ideal of liberty and equality for all the subjects of the Queen. Now, Gandhi could have gone on, practiced law, made a lot of money because it was possible for Indian barristers not only to make a lot of money, but even to win the title of Sir. There were plenty of examples of them. To be a loyal subject of the British Empire and to say, well, that's just how things work. There is one standard of liberty and equality for the white Englishman and subjects of the Queen and another for her colored subjects. But, to use the word that was used in those days, but let's just play the game. Let's just get by and not worry about whether this is absolutely right or absolutely wrong. And besides, you cannot change matters. How can you change matters in the greatest empire in the world in an age of virulent racism? This was an age in which Cecil Rhodes set up his scholarship, the Rhodes Scholarship, for Anglo-Saxons on the belief that they were the superior race. And in which science, as taught in many universities, proclaimed the superiority of the white race. So how can you take on science? How can you take on the legal system? And how can you take on the power of the British Empire? Just go along with it and make a successful life for yourself. After all, you have a family to take care of. And yet, this frail little man, Mohandas Gandhi, armed only with his belief in the truth, his concept of satyagraha, steadfastness in the truth, would take on that great empire and lead his nation, India, to independence and leave us with one of the most profound examples of what one individual can achieve if they believe in the truth. The story of his experiments with the truth is captured in his autobiography, published in two installments in 1925 and 1927, written in, not English, but his Indian language of Gujarati, part of his testimony that Indian culture was his culture, and that is what he should embrace. The story of my experiments with the truth. Because Gandhi was a person who understood that we are always in the course of our life making our way towards the truth. He had a profound belief in God. And he believed, as the Bhagavad Gita, so influential for him, said, that God is truth. And that it is most important to understand that truth itself is God. And that is more important than saying God is truth. Truth is the thing that we worship. And truth is in God. And God will progressively reveal to the searcher for truth wisdom. But you're going to get it wrong a lot of times. And so Gandhi said, I made a lot of mistakes, and he points them out all through his story of his experiments with the truth. I made mistakes that were Himalayan in size, that big, but I kept on. He was born in 1869, and he starts off in his autobiography, very, very mundanely, telling about his family, the caste that they belonged to. And, of course, his whole adult life would be a struggle against caste, to give to the untouchables, those that lay outside of the caste, their rights. Telling about his caste, about his father, his parents, about his early schooling. And schooling made very little impact upon me, he said. I never really learned much from books. And in fact, I can remember almost nothing of the books that my teachers assigned. For me, the teacher ought to be the textbook. And it ought to be the teacher and the moral quality of the teacher that you carry away. So I never learned much from regular schools. I followed the will of my parents and married when I was 13. And my wife was younger. Well, that is the custom in India, he said. I think it is wrong, but I must tell you, I went along with it. And I was a lustful little 13-year-old. I have got to tell you that. In fact, when my father died a few years later, I was so lustful that I was in bed with my wife and I didn't leave to go and hear his dying words. So that was one of my Himalayan mistakes, but I have tried to overcome it, he said. And at the age of 35, I took a vow of absolute celibacy. And from that time onward, I would see my wife not as a creature of lust, but as a creature of true love. And so we would no longer sleep together from that time. So a vow of total celibacy. But that was in the future. When he finished high school and passed his examinations, the discussion was what was going to become of him. And particularly his uncles wanted somebody who would make a lot of money. And the way to do that was become an attorney. So they were going to send him to England. Now, some of the cast members were opposed to this idea, but he was sent off at the age of 18 to England, thinking at that time that the British were the greatest people in the world. And he wanted to be British. So he bought there in Bombay a full outfit of, you know, white pith helmet, white suit, white shoes, and arrived in London in November, with everybody laughing and pointed at him as he strolled down the streets of London in his white outfit. Well, he couldn't be ashamed like that, so he ran off and went right into a London clothier and bought a tuxedo and a tall stovepipe hat. Well, now he even looked more ridiculous walking around the streets of London in a tailor-made tuxedo and a stovepipe hat. Maybe, as he began to think, England wasn't his country. He tried the experiment with eating meat. After all, the English ruled the world, and one of the reasons Indians believe that England, such a small little country the size of Colorado, ruled the world, was they ate meat. Meat must have made them big and strong. So he tried eating meat, and he said, I woke up with the image of a little goat bleeding inside me. Bah, bah, bah. So I joined the Vegetarian Society and went to restaurants there in London where I could at least get vegetarian meals. And gradually I began to come to my understanding of how special my native country was. But you know what led me there?
was not anything I had gotten in schools, but Englishmen themselves. And there in the vegetarian restaurant, I met a number of Englishmen who were deemed eccentric by their fellow countrymen because they wouldn't eat meat and were interested in mystical religions. And they seized upon me as an Indian and they said, "We want you to introduce us to the Bhagavad Gita and teach it to us in Sanskrit." He said, "I don't know Sanskrit. I passed an exam in it in school, but I barely know the alphabet. School exams mean nothing. And I don't know the Bhagavad Gita." "Well, we will read it together." And so in an English translation, I was introduced to the mystic beauty of the Song of God. And it has become such a part of me that I read it every day. I read it while I brush my teeth every day. And he brushed his teeth for 20 minutes a day now, so it's not the 2 minutes that we talk about. While I read it, while I brush my teeth, that Song of God that celebrates God as truth and tells us to follow the path that God has laid out for us, to do the work of someone else's slavery, to do the work of God as true liberation. And that began to shape my thinking and my commitment in life. Now, I would not disappoint my family. I went on and took my examinations and passed at the age of 21. It was amazing how easy it was to become a barrister. All you had to do was to go to 12 dinners, though I never quite understood what going to the dinners at law school, how that helped you become an attorney. And then you had to study this little set of outline notes that everybody could buy. And 95% of the people passed the exams. So it took me a couple of weeks of actual study to pass them. And then I sailed back to India. And there in India, I got my job and went to South Africa, leaving again his wife at home for quite a while. But in South Africa, having been thrown off the train, having been beaten up by the stagecoach driver, Gandhi said, "I realized what God was telling me, not to be afraid and to stand up and to see all of this injustice as being injustice done to God. And God was telling me to put an end to this injustice." And so I began approaching the English legal system. And I sent off letter after letter in the service of these poor, mistreated migrant workers who were forced to live in the filthiest of hovels, who received very poor salary, who had no real legal rights, who were forced to step off the sidewalk even if a white person walked by. I began to write and to look at the law, and I said, "According to a decree of Her Majesty, all of her subjects have equal rights. That decree, much like our Declaration of Independence, conflicts absolutely with the laws in South Africa about segregation. And surely a decree of Her Majesty takes higher place." And so that is how I began. And then I began to try to teach my fellow Indians. You will suffer injustice today. Do not let anyone treat you unjustly. Do not harm anyone. But with all your might, stand fast in the truth, and with every means that is not violent, struggle for your rights. And thus I came to the idea of ahimsa, which is nonviolence. It is not a weak, passive idea. It takes the greatest moral courage not to use violence. Anyone can strike out at someone. To be struck and to stand there and to turn the other cheek and then to go on and say, "I am going to teach you in a nonviolent fashion not to strike me," that is true courage. But I knew we were right, and thus I was steadfast in the truth. So he began his work there in South Africa with the Indians that he would carry on later to India itself. But it was a process not just of fighting for their rights legally, it was of education. And first in South Africa, and then after his return to India, he opened up schools, really communes, where Indians would come and bring their children, holding everything in common. And Gandhi began to try to educate a new generation to ahimsa, to nonviolence, and to satyagraha, the steadfastness in the truth. That, too, was part of his experiments with the truth. And they had no professional teachers. Every one of the parents taught, and Gandhi said, that your parents ought to be the real source of education for you. The greatest possible mistake we make is in turning our children over to professional educators. We should educate them ourselves. Now, I knew almost nothing about Indian history. I knew no Sanskrit. In fact, my knowledge of my own language, Gujarati, was very poor in terms of grammar. But I set about learning these and learning them with the students, and I never tried to fool the students. They said, Gandhi, you don't know this. I said, yes, that's true, I don't know this, but maybe we can learn it together. And then, in India, one day, an untouchable family showed up. You know the untouchables? They are those without a caste. They are given the most menial of task. In fact, there was one set of untouchables that could not even be seen on the street by high caste Hindus. They had to do all of their work, which was cleaning garbage, in the dark of night. And one of these untouchables showed up. And the members of my ashram, that is what it was called, my commune, said, we cannot take them in, they will pollute the well. And I said, what is the meaning of all I have been teaching you? What has been all of our experiments with the truth? If we do not believe that all are equal in the sight of God. Yes, they're equal in the sight of God, we just don't want them here. Then I will leave and go back to practicing law. And he had already developed such a moral authority that this was unthinkable. No, Gandhiji, no, Sir Gandhi, we will let them stay. We will learn from them. And so they did. And so that first great barrier was broken. And now Gandhi began to move to a bigger world, to take on the British Empire itself, because he had come to understand that his mission given to him by God was to have an independent India in which Muslims and Hindus and Christians all live together in unity, and India for Indians. So he abandoned his European clothes and took to wearing just the simple Indian dress. He took up spinning, and the wheel became one of the symbols of their liberation, because Indians were required to buy cloth made in Britain. They grew the cotton, but then it was then shipped to England, made into cloth in the mills of England, and then shipped back. That was a major factor in the economy of England. And he said, we can do without those clothes. And he led mass demonstrations in which European-style clothes and in which the cloth brought from England was burned. And he himself showed the way of how to weave your own cloth, to spin it. And the wheel itself was a symbol of liberation. It was the wheel of life from which the truth could ultimately liberate you. And the wheel that was the sign of God, no beginning and no end. So with these ideas, he took on the British Empire. Salt. The British government received a huge sum of money from its monopoly on salt. You cannot buy salt without paying that tax. But that tax, Gandhi said, is unjust. It goes to support this fabric of oppression. And believe me, the English oppression is not all light-handed. Why, when Indians stood up for their rights at a place called Amritsar in India, they were mowed down by machine gun fire. And the English officer who led them being killed, and then passed the decree that if Indians came down the street and a European approached them, they were to get down on their knees or could be beaten. And that English officer, though lightly punished by the government, received standing ovations by members of Parliament. So that is the English government for you. We will not pay that tax on salt. Where will we get our salt, Gandhi? Gandhiji, or as he was already being called, the Mahatma, the great-souled one. We will march to the sea. But they will stop us. No, they will beat us. But that will not stop us. They beat us. We nurse our wounded. We tell them, you will not stop us, but we will not harm you. And then we will just keep marching. Go into the mines where you are being mistreated. They will beat you if you stand up against them. But let them beat you. Do nothing violent to them, but just keep coming back. And world opinion in England, began to focus on this one frail little man. And Indians, Muslim as well as Hindus, as well as Christians, So in this figure, the symbol of their struggle for liberation and enlightenment, the idea that England and Europe was not the only source of culture and ideas, that India had its own fundamental set of ideas that were foreign to the West. Your culture, Gandhi said to the English, is based upon violence. It is based upon war and struggle, and capitalism itself is a form of violence. It literally robs from the poor in order to make the wealthier richer. It is a system that has in itself the seeds of its destruction. We do not want to import it. Our Indian way is the way of God and truth and of nonviolence. Gandhi then found in prison, for he was thrown into jail again and again, new sources of strength. And not just in the literature of India, but John Ruskin's work, Unto This Last, a work that is never read today, but in which Gandhi found truth so gripping that he could not put it down during an entire night, that the good of all is encompassed in the good of one individual. So if you harm one individual, if you let injustice, either passive or active, be done to one individual, you have harmed everyone. And two, that every form of work has its own dignity. And the barber is just as much worthy of your respect as is the attorney. And finally, perhaps the noblest form of work, though, is to farm and to make something with your own hands. So do not be ashamed, Indians, of farming. Do not be ashamed of being artisans. Do not think that you have to adopt the European way of ever greater progress and ever greater wealth. Be yourselves. And then, Leon Tolstoy's The Kingdom of God is Within Yourself. Gandhi says in his Experiments with the Truth that opened a whole new world for him. Now today, The Kingdom of God is Within You by Tolstoy is looked upon by literary critics as part of his old age and dotage. That is to say, he had written these great novels, War and Peace, that's what you ought to read, Anna Karenina. And then in his old age, he suddenly got religion and said that Jesus was a very great man, but he was not God. What he taught was every one of you has God inside yourself. And Gandhi said, I had read that in the Bhagavad Gita, but somehow seen that this Russian who had achieved such success with his literature and then went back to this simple life, wanted to sell all of his possessions and just follow Christ. Christ's lesson to sell all you have and give it to the poor. That gave it new meaning to me. So it is not always those books which are on a reading list of great books, but strange, out-of-the-way books that you find that can touch you as they did Gandhi. And in prison, and then in his self-imposed hunger strikes. For if the British did not do what he thought was right, or if his own followers quarreled and refused to follow the path of truth and nonviolence, he would start starving himself to death, and he meant it. He would go for days without eating. And such was his moral authority that the British Raj, the government itself, trembled that he might die, and they would give in. Thus he had harmed no one and brought about truth. And ultimately, his moral authority played the role, one, in Britain's decision to let India go free, and to the decision of so many Indians to come together and form political parties that could achieve that freedom under a constitutional government. But his bitter disappointment came in 1947 and 48 when India gained its independence but allowed itself to be divided between a largely Muslim Pakistan and a largely Hindu India. That is to undo all we have tried to do. That is to say that we are not all one in God. For Gandhi believed God has fashioned, just as the Bhagavad Gita said, many roads to the truth. The Hindu, the Christian, the Jew, the Muslim, they are all on that same path. All religions teach the same fundamental values. We are all one. Do not have a Muslim and a Hindu India. But it came to pass. Civil war broke out over disputed territory, and thousands were killed, And this poor, frail, now very old man walked from little village to village, staying with Hindus, staying with Muslims, trying to bring them together. And his very moral authority had become a threat. And radicals who wanted a truly separate Hindu India set out to assassinate him. And one day, walking along in the midst of this civil war, a young man stepped from the crowd and shot him. And the last words that Gandhi spoke were, "Ram, God." And we think of the Bhagavad Gita, that he who dies with my name upon his lips is freed forever from the cycle of life and joins me in bliss.